Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Portland City Council. Before we get started, we have a couple of a proclamation and a recognition of Roosevelt High School's homecoming weekend. So I'll turn it over to Commissioner Commissioner Fish for the proclamation.
Thank you, President Saltzman. Would our friends from the Timbers please come forward and take a seat, Mike? So, good morning. And before we get started today, just grab a, is there, do you need an extra seat?
Yeah.
Just pull one back, Kristen. I'd like to present a proclamation this morning on behalf of Mayor Adams and the Council to the Portland Timbers. We're joined today by Mike Golub, the Timbers Chief Operating Officer, Timbers Director of Community Relations, Krista Torres, who's also a new member of our Portland Parks Board, former Timbers player and alumni ambassador Mike Hoban, an original Timber, who also played for a team called Ashton Villa. I've never heard of them. And
that was my dad's team.
I'm sorry. I stole her line. And Portland Timbers defender Chris Taylor. Chris, welcome, and we wish you a speedy recovery. Next week, the Portland Timbers will be bringing Portlanders together throughout our great city for Stand Together Week, a full week of community service activities. And before we hear a little bit more about that, I'm going to read the proclamation. Whereas the city of Portland is proud to be home to the Portland Timbers, our Major League Soccer team, and whereas the Portland Timbers are committed to giving back to our community, and whereas the city of Portland is proud to partner with the Portland Timbers in organizing Stand Together, a week of community service from October 8th through October 14th, 2012, and whereas 1,000 Stand Together volunteers, including Timbers players, the Timbers Army, coaches, ambassadors, staff, community members, will come together for a week of service, and whereas Stand Together volunteers will participate in over 40 community events and projects throughout our city, and whereas community service projects will include building homes, tending gardens, restoring local parks, pulling ivy, painting schools, and much more. And whereas Stand Together will support local, mission-driven nonprofits, including Habitat for Humanity, the Native American Youth and Family Center, the American Red Cross, Hands on Greater Portland, among many others. And whereas Stand Together is a call to action by the city, the Portland Timbers, and our community partners to inspire people to give back through community service. Now, therefore, I, Sam Adams, Mayor of the City of Portland, City of Roses, do hereby proclaim October 8th through 14th, 2012, as Portland Timbers Stand Together Week in Portland, and encourage all residents to recognize and join in this week of service to our community. Would you please join me this morning in thanking the Timbers for their commitment to making this a better place? And with that, Mike Golub, would you please take it away?
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner Fish, and thanks, City Council, for your ongoing partnership and recognition of this week. We're enormously proud of the community work we do throughout the year, but this week is special. It's really a manifestation of all the great work that our team does, our players do, and our fans. We have an incredibly philanthropic and community-minded fan base, and this is a week of 40 projects, as the proclamation referenced, throughout the city, with a great variety of incredible nonprofits doing great work for people in need. And every player, every coach, every staff member, and 1,000 fans and people of the public are participating. So we're very proud of it, and we appreciate the recognition.
Krista?
I would just add that I think the city and the team really, the city and the fans in Portland really give so much to our team, and we're really happy to be able to give back.
Fantastic. Krista, you were a soccer player in your day too, right?
I was, yes.
Fantastic. Chris, you want to say something?
I'm actually going to be out in Happy Valley planting trees with none other than Timber Joey.
Wait a second.
He plants trees?
He's planting them. He's coming down in about 10 years.
Oh, okay.
He's atoning, Dan.
Okay.
It's the week of atonement.
And again, you can sign up on the website to come join me. And all of the players, whoever you want to see, you can sign up to come volunteer with them as well.
Now, when we're finished, Amanda's going to ask you, Mike, what the website is and where we can get the information. Mike, you're the You're the ambassador for the team. You're one of the original Timbers, and you were a big star here and in Europe. So we're really honored to have you with us today.
Big in terms of my size these days. I started in April of 1975 working with the Timbers, and I'm proud to see this is really the culmination of community work over the years, where it's all come together and knitted together very nicely. I'm very proud to have been part of this great franchise, and thanks to the city for helping to put Portland on the international football map. Thank you.
When did you play for Aston Villa?
In the early 1970s.
Oh, I bet my dad was watching you.
Well, he also told us earlier that Birmingham has how many premier clubs?
Well, we only recognize one, which is Aston Villa.
Right.
There is another team called Birmingham City, so there's quite
Never
a rivalry. Never heard of it, no.
Well, thank you very much.
Mike, how can people get information if they want to sign up or learn about opportunities?
Yeah, we still have some spots available. PortlandTimbers.com, stand together, and there's a whole list and outline of all the projects every day, every time slot, which player has been assigned and participating in each project. So for those who are still interested, jump on our website and sign up.
Now, the council would like to get a quick picture with you if we could.
Sure.
Now we have a wonderful opportunity before we start our normal business to welcome some students from Roosevelt High School, and it is their homecoming weekend this weekend, and we have Andre, Abby, and Megan who are going to talk to us about the homecoming weekend. So if you three could come up here. Good to see Rough Riders in our chambers. So whoever wants to start, why don't you just give us your name and tell us what grade you are, too.
So my name is Andre McKellen. I'm the ASB president at Roosevelt, and we're here with our RHS student government behind us.
Okay. My name is Megan. I'm senior class president.
And my name is Abby Passion. I'm junior class vice president.
Great. Did you want to tell us about homecoming weekend briefly?
Or? So first we want to talk a little bit about how our school has been improving.
Move the mic a little closer to you so we can hear you.
So we want to talk a little bit about how our school is improving. So we have a saying around our school that Roosevelt is on the rise. And that's truly important to us because we have been improving over the last 3 years. So we've doubled our incoming freshman class. My freshman year, we had a class of 150. And this year we have 300 freshmen. So it's a huge jump for us, and our graduation rates are going up, and student involvement is definitely going up. When you look at our clubs, you see every club has a really big student body in it. And so that's really important to us. And so you see that the student body is improving. And then we also want to talk a little about how the bond measure is going to affect us. And so you know that the student body is improving, and also we need our school building to improve. And so Abby's going to talk about that.
So in case that you weren't aware, I'm also the Roosevelt student intern on the Our Portland, Our Schools bond campaign. I work on the communications team. So I just wanted to give a little spiel about it, why I support the bond as a student. Because as a student at Roosevelt High School, I attend this school. I've been attending Portland Public Schools since I was in fifth grade. So I've had firsthand personal experience in these crumbling buildings, and that the conditions really do take an effect on myself and other students, because you can't concentrate when the building around you is crumbling. And it also affects teachers who can't move around classrooms or give attention or help to the students when they themselves are affected by small classrooms, lack of equipment in labs, things like that. And I just want a better, a safer future for my younger siblings, because I do have younger siblings, and a better, safer future for future Roosevelt Rough Riders, that they can actually be proud that they got a degree at Roosevelt High School, that they graduated, and they don't have to go through the same, honestly, miserable things that we have to go through school every day, not just at Roosevelt, but at high schools all around the Portland Public Schools area. And that we as students, and we are the future of Portland and the future of the world, we have a voice. And even though we can't vote yet, I feel like we still deserve to talk about these issues that we feel so passionate about. So that's what I wanted to say about the school bond.
Well, thanks, Abby.
And with that, we wanted to invite everyone to homecoming.
Yeah, so this is a big week for us. As you know, before homecoming, it's Spirit Week. Monday was Breast Cancer Awareness Day, so everybody in the student body wore pink, or at least that's what was supposed to be, what that was supposed to happen. And Tuesday, yesterday, was actually
Crazy Hat Day.
I wore my pink hat with the ball on it. All right, and today is Twin Day / Mustache Day. We didn't want to wear our mustaches in here. Seem more professional. But yeah, this is Spirit Week, and our freshmen are really taking it really good, too. This is a good experience for them, something they never had in middle school, a Spirit Week, so they're getting really excited about it. But most importantly, on Friday, that's the big day for us. We play Madison, a rival school, something. Our sports teams are doing really well, and Madison, they're having a great season along with our Riders, so it's going to be a pretty well-matched game. But at noon, the festivities start. We have a parade. Our student government's going to be in the parade. And our homecoming court is going to be in the parade. Hopefully, I win king. But, yeah. And then starting at 3 is our pep rally. And at 5 o'clock, we're going to have a bonfire / barbecue. So come out and enjoy the festivities with the student body.
Well, great. Well, thank you. Did you have something you wanted to add?
Okay. And could I just add something? Last spring, my Multnomah County Commissioner, Sophia Keske, set up a forum. And we met with some seniors and juniors at Roosevelt. We had a civics class. And we've been doing that at a number of high schools. And my impression was it was one of the most engaged classes of people we've met. Everybody either read a newspaper or listened to the radio or followed the news, and they had strong opinions on issues. And there were a lot of people actually interested in public service. And so I just want to congratulate you for what you're achieving there and just tell you that people are noticing that your school is on the rise, and you have a lot to do with that.
And I plan to be at the dinner tomorrow evening, and I just want to remind everybody in Portland that this council invested $200,000 in the Roosevelt Athletics Improvements. Sometimes people wonder why we would do that during a recession, and the answer is because we care about the students at Roosevelt, and we believe that you deserve the best of facilities for recreation and for sports, as well as for the great academic achievements that you've been making. So thank you all for coming to talk to us this morning and for doing what you need to do, staying in school, getting your diplomas, and telling us all about it. Roosevelt is on the rise.
Thank you.
I'd just like to say it's great to see the student body, the student body government. It's really good to see people getting involved at the local level. And Roosevelt definitely is on the rise. And we're very proud of you. And you keep up the good work because you're really good ambassadors for Roosevelt. So thank you and good luck on Friday against Madison.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, now we will begin our formal meeting. Carla, could you please call the roll?
Leonard. Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Adams.
Okay, our first item, we have communications. So if you could read the first communication, please. Mm-hmm.
Item 1105, request of Francis Quamps Miller to address council regarding the undemocratic procedure behind water fluoridation.
Mr. Miller or Ms. Miller? Okay. Why don't you read the next communication?
1106, request of Jimmy Tardy to address council regarding camping ban.
Tardy?
Good morning.
Welcome. If you could please take a seat.
Yes, I'd be happy to.
And give us
a... leave this here where you can see it. And I'll take the opportunity to let you all see what I have put together
I'm here to talk about...
Before you start, we need your...
Let's talk about what we call the camping ban.
Excuse me. Give us your name, please.
Oh, I'm Jimmy Target.
Okay, and you have 3 minutes.
Oh, thank you very much. So I'm here to talk about what has been come to be known as the camping ban. And as you came into City Hall today, you may have noticed a vigil on the patio of City Hall, which has been here since December of last year. So we're closing in on a year. The vigil is to request one thing of City Council. We're asking City Council to restore some humanity to the ordinances relating to people protecting themselves from the elements on the street. And I came to realize that part of the problem is some confusion. We call it the camping ban. And just for the City Council members, I'd like to point out, the middle of the diorama here, this is what we all think of when we think of camping. You'll notice people are out of the woods, they've got a campfire, they've got a tent, and there's trees and sleeping bags. These are important. I'd like to just let everybody else just briefly see what I'm referring to here. Nobody's confused about this as being camping. Well, next to this, you'll notice a scene which may look familiar to you, which we call living on the street. This is not camping. And I understand that there's some confusion, and I understand why there might be some confusion, because there's a lot of similarities, like there's trees and there's people in sleeping bags. But this is not camping. The people in the middle who are camping probably want to be there. They're probably having a good time. The people on the side here who are living on the street probably don't want to be there, and they're probably not having a good time. Language is that important that it gives us false impressions. That's what I'm here to talk about today, is the false impression that we create when we call this a camping ban. This is not a camping ban. This is a ban against people getting to have that most basic human function called sleep. And I also like to just point to the other side of the diorama here, which may look familiar to you as well. And let me apologize first off just for how shabby City Hall is. But let me just say, this is protesting. And you can tell protesting because oftentimes there'll be signs, which I have some miniatures here. And I also like to say that there's one other little aspect of protesting that sort of sets it apart. And besides the signs and the people maybe holding a vigil out in front of City Hall, you also notice that there's a concentration of courage kind of in this area right here. I'd just like to point out to you that the courage is concentrated right here.
Mr. Tardy, your time is up. So
thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Could you please read the next communication, Carla?
Item 1107, request of Mary Eng to address council regarding Half the Sky Project for Global, Political, Civic, and Economic Empowerment of Women.
Okay. Well, welcome, Mary. And just give us your name, and you have 3 minutes.
My name is Mary Eng, and I would like to request that the undemocratic restraint of minutes allowed to public matters of importance be extended as per the previous allowance. I'm here to speak today about Half the Sky, the AHA Foundation, Karma Nirvana, Fair Girls, and Women Under Siege. AHA Foundation has recently trained the NYPD on understanding honor violence and honor killing. Karma Nirvana was founded by Jasvinder Singera in England, and she's reaching out to members of parliament to help understand systems of honor violence and forced marriage and child marriage. So her hotline has been very important and instrumental in helping women who are under threat of honor violence to have resources to go to. Fair Girls deals with sex trafficking in America, child trafficking, and sex trafficking. So I urge you to check them out. And Women Under Siege deals with torture in Syria and stereotypes of the hijab being a prevention of rape. We have previously talked about the Nicholas Kristof article, Is Rape Serious, in terms of failure of the NYPD and the Los Angeles Police Department failures to assess DNA rape evidence. We've also talked about issues pertaining to the violence that homeless women experience on the street is an undue form of gender-based violence. I think with the Half the Sky Project, which is put on by Cheryl Wudunn and Nicholas Kristof, it's very important to realize that we need to connect the global with the local. It's easy to say, oh, child trafficking of women in India is a sad thing. Well, we ignore and turn a blind eye on the homeless women on the street. Here's my friend Matthew, who does social work on the street, which is unsalaried, which pertains to women who experience violence as homeless people.
Thank you, Mary. Mary's very well read, and she puts a lot of work in this. Please take what she says seriously. I do appreciate what you said, Mary. Thanks for listening to me today. She caught me a little unexpected, so please excuse my dress. I would like to agree with Mary that, you know, I've been out there probably last year or whatnot, and there's a very serious issue out there with these women. Some were extremely frightened. I think we recently had that serial killer that was caught. And the police, when they drive around at night, and I'm not saying they are intentionally doing anything wrong, but it can be scary, by the way. They're always looking at everyone they're going at. And I've seen women that won't talk to anyone cuddling into corners scared, you know, if you try to offer them help or whatnot. And again, I'd like to say it's a very scary scene to see and to have them hiding under bridges. I think it really definitely should be looked at. I'd be happy to speak more when you guys have time. You know where to find me. I'm out front about what I've seen and what's going on, because I think it's important that we address this. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your commitment to ending gender-based violence
in Portland. Okay, if you could, Carla, if you could read our two time certains. I don't think we have that consent. Yeah, there is no consent.
Item 1108. Declare October 2012 Domestic Violence Awareness Month in the City of Portland. And item 1109, accept the report on 2 years of operation of the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services.
Okay, well, today we declare October 2012 as Domestic Violence Awareness Month and commit ourselves as a city to doing more to end the cycle of violence in our community. Domestic violence continues to be a pervasive problem in our city, accounting for approximately 5,000 calls for police service each year. Part of this council's commitment to stopping the cycle of violence has been opening the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services in September of 2010. The county is also a partner in this Gateway Center. So for the last 2 years, the Gateway Center has created an entryway to supportive services that make it easier for victims of domestic violence to receive a variety of services under one roof. The Gateway Center brings together 19 different government and private sector and private partners to cohesively serve victims and their children. The Gateway Center and its staff is also transforming the type of services available to victims of domestic violence. One of those system improvements is Turbo Court, which you will hear more about today from Judge Maureen McKnight, the Chief Family Court Judge in Multnomah County. And we also have Oregon Supreme Court Chief Justice Thomas Ballmer. But first, it gives me great pleasure to bring forward our director, Gateway Center Director Martha Strawn Morris. Welcome, Martha.
Thank you.
Yeah, judges, yeah, you can come forward also.
Good morning, commissioners. Thank you so much for having me. I'm Martha Strawn Morris, the director of the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services, and I'm really pleased to be here as we open Domestic Violence Awareness Month to give the second annual report of the success of the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services.
Thank you.
Oops. Sorry, Carla, this is not advancing. There we go. But before I get into the bones of my presentation, I'd like to remind everybody about what the Gateway Center is. As the commissioner said, it's a one-stop shop that co-locates a wide variety of services for victims and survivors of domestic violence and their children. We built it in partnership with Multnomah County and a wide variety of other private and public partners. The center itself is really warm and welcoming, and we operate at a public address on 102nd and East Burnside, so we don't do this work in secret. We're right out in the open and accessible to folks from Portland. But the bones of the presentation that I'm going to talk about today are what I think of as the linchpins of our service delivery model. And I'm going to touch on those linchpins of the service delivery model, but also give an additional slide about lessons that we've learned related to each of the four areas in the past year. Starting with child care services, I think child care, having accessible child care, is really important at the Gateway Center. We have a lot of parents with young children seeking services there. And there's a lot of work that goes on, efforts that are made by survivors in the Gateway Center that would be almost impossible to do with a young child at your knee. For example, trying to file a police report or apply for a restraining order is really, really tough to do anyway, but almost impossible if your 2- and 3-year-old are needing you at the same time. So we're grateful to the city's investment in our child care services, and we feel it's really crucial. But beyond that, I'd like to take a moment today to emphasize the additional children's services we have. I think our children's services are about prevention and mitigating the impact of domestic violence on secondary survivors. We have Volunteers of America Home Free doing support groups for kids and outreach in the schools to prevent dating violence, as well as offering advocacy one-on-one and parenting support. And this year we've added a therapist from Impact Northwest who works with parents and children together, again, who've experienced violence in their home. And I really think that these services are going to prevent some from becoming victims and perpetrators of violence in the next generation. And if I could just put my advocacy hat on for a moment, since we're here on Domestic Violence Awareness Month, I think it's time for us all to ask ourselves what we can do to stop domestic violence. And my two top recommendations in that area are, one, support the agencies that work directly with survivors and their children. They need our support. They work very hard, and they're busy breaking the cycle of violence every day. But the second would be, and this doesn't cost anybody a penny, is talk to the young people around you about what a healthy relationship is, what you think it is, ask them what they think it is. We need to arm the next generation to be prepared to recognize and reject unhealthy relationship behaviors. We need the next generation to demand healthy relationships in their own partnerships, and we can all help with that every day. Our survivors fill out a checkout form when they leave each day, and we ask them if there's anything else they want to tell us about their visit. That's where these quotes come from that I'm sharing. We hear a lot of support for children's services and access to child care. People really appreciate it. The second linchpin of our service delivery model is navigators. Navigators are advocates that we have in the building. They come from 6 different community-based organizations, all organizations I would urge you to support. The advocates work as a team under my staff, 2 of whom are here today. Just like to acknowledge Karina and Diana, who are my amazing staff here. Thank you for your efforts over the past 2 years. The navigators design individual customized services for each survivor that comes in. They're experts at safety planning, at danger assessment. They help ensure that each person is given the services that are most important to them. And without the navigators, we wouldn't be able to deliver these individualized services. But this year, we've come to really understand how important the drop-in aspect of our service model is to folks. Because we have the navigators who don't work on appointments, we can take walk-ins all day, every day that we're open. And we are hearing and understanding from the community, from our partners and survivors, it's of critical importance to the way these services are delivered. 80% of the folks that come to the Gateway Center are walk-ins. So it's 4 out of 5, and the navigators meet with all of those folks. Last year, we had more than 2,000 brand new survivors come to the center. and the survivors really love the navigators. We probably hear more praise for the navigators than we do anything else. The third thing that the Gateway Center makes the Gateway Center work is the wide variety of services that we offer. In the interest of time, I'm not going to read all these agency names, but they each provide unique and critical services so that survivors can kind of design their own menu of service with the help of the navigators. And I think without this variety, this amazing variety of public and private services that are offered, we just wouldn't be the same place. I want to talk a little bit about our highest demand services, but be cautious because the variety is really important. I'm not making an argument about shifting any resources from one service to another. Any given day, a particular service could be the difference for a particular survivor between safety and danger or even life and death. And so I'm not arguing to change the variety. We need that. But if you want to know the services that are operating at capacity basically every day, it's these three. Those provided by the Department of Human Services, those provided by Legal Aid Services of Oregon, and those provide the mental health services provided by LifeWorks Northwest. I am very proud that we are, I believe, a non-stigmatizing place to access mental health services in our community. We have a lot of people seeking those services. If I had my dream, I would have a lot more civil legal access. Folks really, really need access to the courts. They need custody of their kids and to be able to get divorced to move forward in their lives, and I'd like to see a lot more of those services. We actually are on deck to get another Department of Human Services case manager out of the Gateway Center, so that's exciting. That will help with that capacity issue. One participant said that the staff helped her with things she didn't even know she needed help with. It was a wonderful experience. And finally, the aspect of our service delivery model that I want to focus on is the access to restraining orders. Because we have a video conference feed to the downtown courthouse in partnership with the Multnomah County Circuit Court, we can help somebody through the whole application process from the paperwork that they have to fill out all the way to their appearance that they make before a judge to getting their order. So in the past year, we've had almost 1,000 applications filed at the Gateway Center. We believe that represents about 40% of all of Multnomah County's orders. The first year in operation, we did about 25%, so we saw a real increase. And we're one of just a few judicial districts that saw an increase in restraining order applications in 2011 over the previous year, and we have reason to believe that that's because the Gateway Center has created access for folks who really couldn't get a restraining order otherwise. So it's been a really important part of what we do. And today, I am so pleased to be joined by these esteemed members of the Oregon Judicial Department to talk about a partnership that's helped us create a new tool that Commissioner Saltzman referred to. I like to think that we are evolving our service delivery mechanisms all the time. We're looking for efficiencies and improvements and ways to make things easier for survivors. And this is just a wonderful example of both partnership and a tool that we've been able to build working together. This was funded through a federal grant that the city of Portland got specifically to do this. So what we did is took a restraining order packet. The forms are laid out at the Gateway Center on that counter you see in the picture. That's a restraining order application. An applicant has to fill out every one of those forms to get a restraining order, and we turned it into an interactive questionnaire. I actually have a packet in my bag that I didn't bring up to show you how many forms it is, but I think you can take my word for it. It's a lot.
That picture is very graphic illustration of all the paperwork. Yes.
It's a lot of paperwork. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Judge Maureen McKnight, who's the Chief Family Court Judge here in Multnomah County. And I'd also like to acknowledge that the Chief of the Multnomah County Circuit Court is here, Judge Dan Waller. Thank you for being here, as well as members of the DA's office and police and other partners from the Gateway Center. So thank you, everybody.
Thanks,
right. Good morning, Commissioners, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today about this partnership. I've had the opportunity to work really closely with Martha, Commissioner Saltzman, and his office, and some of the advocates here in the courtroom in developing this this new process for obtaining restraining orders. And I'm going to talk just briefly about some of the benefits and the functionality. As Martha mentioned, we've had the capacity to do video conference appearances for individuals seeking restraining orders for about
it's been about 2 years now, I think.
It has been.
It has been. Gosh, it seems like it's been going on. Part of us, integral part of the court. And what the new turbo court process does is really allow us to take that same theme of efficiency and convenience to the next level. It isn't that the technology is so cutting edge that no one else in the country has it, because a few jurisdictions are going the same way for the efficiency and convenience and access purposes. But what the partnership with the city has allowed us to do is to take a big step to getting Oregon courts on the road to where technology is taking us, and rightfully so. And that's because, as you saw from the prior picture, traditionally to fill out court forms, one has hard copies of forms that one then has to fill out by hand. And for a litigant under the Family Abuse Prevention Act, or FAPA, that's over 20 pages of material to fill out, not counting instructions and not counting documents that are geared specifically for the other side, for the respondent. That's flat out formidable to anyone, much less someone without a lawyer, in crisis, perhaps with injuries that impair concentration, or a restless two-year-old in tow and trying to figure out where one's going to sleep that night. So having a web-based program that is accessible 24/7, where it can be stopped, answers saved, and started again to meet someone's needs, done on a work computer if necessary, or at the library or courthouse even, that is simply a much more user-friendly process. And if the just looking for the slides, and I think Martha's putting that on there. Right. You can just give you a, thank you, a few screenshots. This is the initial page, and it's pretty a lot of text on this because they're on the very first page, unlike the next ones as we see when we go. But you can see a drop-down menu there, and that is one of the various ways a litigant is filling out forms. One isn't seeing a fillable PDF, one is answering questions, and then the answers to the questions automatically populate the form that is printed out at the end. So the litigant is either answering a drop-down menu, such as you see there, or hitting a radio button option, you know, a list of choices, or maybe typing text into a particular screen describing a particular incident. And what is, I think, very beneficial is that the answers to the questions drive the branches of the logic trees. For example, if you're asked, do you have children with the respondent, and the answer is no, you're going to jump over all of the questions in a restraining order process that deal with the child and where the child's lived and where the child should be and that type of thing. So it's more efficient for the litigant. I think there's a very obvious benefit for judges in terms of legibility. We handle on average 10 a day, and we have gone as high as 28. So, and we have a limited amount of time daily to hear these applications. So the more legible a document is, the quicker we can understand what the litigant is saying has happened. It allows us to help more people given limited resources. Another, if you want to flip to the next page, this page really demonstrates another component of the program we're particularly excited about, and that is the
It's this one.
The one with the circle, the green circle, showing the FAQs. And that's because not just court staff, but domestic violence advocates and others spend a lot of time explaining basic procedural information to individuals who want restraining orders. And they're saying throughout the day the same, giving the same answers to the same questions, you know, in sequence. What we've done is taken dozens and dozens of those common questions and put them into FAQs so that when a litigant is going through the process and a particular term or an issue raised by the page prompts a question, very, very likely there's going to be an answer on that side just a click away in terms of giving them the information that we need. There's also a safety component I wanted to emphasize, and that is that we all know that in domestic violence situations, the most dangerous time is the point of separation. And by having a product that's accessible 24/7, that, as I said before, can be started, answer saved, gone back to, even in a different location, it allows individuals to make a more planned, careful departure in an environment that is an extremely stressful one. So we do think it's more convenient, it's more accessible, it is more efficient for not just advocates and the litigant and also the court, but situationally, we do believe it safer as well. I wanted to mention three other functions just briefly, or three other benefits, I should say. And one is that the, if you want to flip to the next page, the program allows an individual to repeat the query if one wanted to change the order, for example. So we have different paths, not just for the petitioner who wants to come in to get the order, but to modify it or even to dismiss it, since we know safety needs are fluid and do change. But the respondent, too, has the capability of using to sign on username and password protected, and to ask that provisions of the order be changed, say perhaps about the children, or even to challenge the order. But once having used this process, one doesn't have to repeat all of the contact info and all of the addresses and all of the information that was already in the program. You can simply switch paths and deal with the new issue, or if you do have a new contact address. So it's got that increased efficiency and ease for the user. And secondly, the program has a capacity to interface with translation programs. We are do have on track Spanish language, not there yet, but it is in the plan. And thirdly, and I think this is probably the segue to Chief Justice Ballmer, the digital product that's produced is really what we need for e-filing, which is where eCourt is going. We've taken a giant step here, not just for improving legal access for DV victims, but really improving access for, and again, not just family law litigants, but legal access for all Oregonians, because we're piloting here the exact path that the Oregon courts intend to take in terms of user access to the court system. And with that, I think I will turn it to the Chief Justice.
Thank you. I'm Tom Ballmer. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and as such, the administrative head of the Oregon Judicial Branch. And I'm just here batting cleanup to emphasize the Judicial Branch's support for the Gateway Center and for similar collaborative projects with local governments and agencies. I want to thank the mayor and the council for the city's support and the city's financial contribution in making the interactive forms that Judge McKnight showed us and the rest of the infrastructure at Gateway available for people who are seeking restraining orders and other services. This really is the sort of thing we're going to have to do a lot more of in the future, where you were able to get a federal grant, you were able to help staff the center, the county was able to provide the building, I think, at a time of budget cuts, and we've cut 15% of our personnel in the judicial branch over the last 5 years. We don't have extra people, we don't have extra money to do all the things that we ought to be doing, and we need to be able to work with the city, with cities around the state and with counties to do this sort of efficient and innovative effort to provide access to people, access to the courts for people throughout the state. Judge McKnight mentioned our statewide e-court program. That's now fully implemented at the appellate level, and we're rolling it out in the trial courts over the next 4 years. And these FAPA proceedings are a really good example of how, with interactive forms, with remote video hookups between, say, a domestic violence center like this and the courthouse, and e-filing, electronic filing, we can, with less cost and greater efficiency, provide people with access to the courts. And so for that reason, we're particularly happy to join with you and with the county in this project. I want to just close with this thought. Very few domestic violence cases, very, very few restraining orders ever get to the Supreme Court. We spend most of our time, we're supposed to, on constitutional law issues, death penalty cases, major business or tort litigation. But I actually have gone out and sat as a trial judge hearing restraining order applications in domestic violence cases. And it's an eye-opening experience for a Supreme Court, just let me tell you. Those cases, like small claims court, like misdemeanors, like family law matters, they really are where the rubber meets the road as far as the citizens go. That's where most people interact with the court system. It's actually where most people interact with government at all. And each of those cases, even though they may seem small in the big scheme of things, They are a huge deal to the women and men and children that are involved, and we owe it to those citizens to provide convenient and efficient access to the courts for those kinds of cases. And the Gateway Center is a model for doing that. So thank you again for working with us and with Multnomah County on this important project.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. It's an honor to have you. And Judge McKnight, I just want to say that Judge McKnight has really worked hard to get this Turbo Court up and running, as has Martha Strawn Morris. And we're really happy that this forms a good, solid cornerstone of the state's larger e-court efforts. We appreciate you being here. I don't know if my colleagues have any questions.
I have one, if I could. I can't resist, but we have the Chief Justice. Normally, careful.
The tables are turned. I know.
It's probably been a breach of protocol. Dan should probably offered you the share up here with the big gavel. But, Mr. Chief Justice, since you alluded to the fact that there have been substantial cuts in the court system, and since today we're talking about a unique partnership where county and the city, nonprofits, the court system are trying to sort of triage and fill a gap. Would you care to offer an opinion about whether at the current levels of funding today and projected, whether we are actually at risk of closing the doors of access to justice statewide if we continue on the path of underfunding our judiciary?
Well, if we are not able to restore trial court operations monies, and I know I'm not talking to the group that controls our budget, but I will be in January. We are going to experience greater delays. We're going to experience long time periods between the judge issuing an order and it actually getting entered in a judgment. We had an experience in Lane County where, in a family law matter, somebody came in ex parte hearing, and the other side actually had filed a response. This was on a custody matter. The other side had filed a response, but it did not get entered. It did not get to the judge in time, and the judge gave custody to a different parent. And that is potentially dangerous. It creates potential for liability on the part of the state, and that's not the way the system is supposed to work. Most of the proceedings like this, we expect to have two parties. We expect to have it decided by a judge. The judge does the best he or she can. But to have a situation where somebody has filed papers, has intended to appear, but the judge never heard about that and so changed a custody order, that is very troubling. We also have situations where arrest warrants are not cleared in time. We have circumstances where people may be arrested for, say, not showing up at a court appearance, and actually they had already taken care of that, but because we hadn't been able to process the paperwork showing that they actually had come in and paid their fine, they are still out there with an outstanding warrant of some kind. So it's like the frog in the pot. As you turn the water up, the heat gets higher and higher, and the frog never knows to jump out. We will continue to see small cracks in the system. We're already starting to see some cracks now. So one of our first pitches to the state legislature is going to be for money to restore trial court operations that we've had to cut over the last 5 years. And if you go into Multnomah County Circuit Court, you'll see empty desks because Judge Waller and Trial Court Administrator Doug Bray have had to cut about 15% of their staff over the past 5 years, and that's true in our central services at the State Court Administrator's Office, and it's true in other circuit courts around the state. So thank you for the opportunity to make that important point.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for being here, and we will move to public testimony before we take a vote. Do we have anybody signed up?
We have two people. Please come on up, Mary Eng and Theodore Benjamin Landon.
Welcome, Mary. Give us your name, and you have 3 minutes.
Hi, my name is Mary Eng. Just to put this in a frame of reference, I want to let you know my personal confidential information that I myself was blinded by a man who ripped my glasses off my face. He stomped on my skull, destroying my glasses and inflicting a large number of bruises on me, and this was in 2000 in Nashville, Tennessee. I was also raped by a man who strangled me and told me he would kill me if I didn't stop screaming. So after that, I had a very severe speech impediment that was related to the PTSD trauma. So I think one of the issues I wanted to bring up in regards to this domestic violence work is that we have had some significant rapes on PSU's campus, particularly in the student rec center restroom. And I would love to make PSU a rape-free campus. Also, we have many returning soldiers, 1,200 returning soldiers who are coming back. And I've worked with a liaison to the Veterans Administration to get some expertise on PTSD, as is experienced by military rape and military sexual trauma survivors, as well as PTSD from the battlefield. So I think that really ties in with these issues of protection from violence and trauma. And then also in regards to the electronic filing, I really appreciate this because I know of a story of a woman who was actually killed at her restraining order hearing by her partner, who she had to face. And that kind of fear should be eliminated if possible. And also, I just wanted to put in a word for the Service Women's Action Network, because a lot of the stigmatization that came with military rape included the don't ask, don't tell prohibitions on homosexuality. And male soldiers might have felt that if they were rape victims, they could not bring up their rape and bring it forward to the community. So I think we really need to remove the stigma for men and children who have been raped of all genders and be very inclusive about our domestic violence treatment. Thank you so much.
Hey, is there anybody else who didn't sign up who wishes to testify? Okay. Seeing none, then
I'll move the resolution.
Okay. Go ahead and call the roll.
On 1108?
Yes.
Fritz.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Saltzman, for your leadership and everybody who testified today. This is an amazing project, which we have funded in the middle of the recession by partnerships, as was discussed. And the report says that in the first 2 years, 4,149 individuals were served and 1,544 children. And that's evidence both of the good work of the center and also of the prevalence of this challenge in our community. And domestic violence is something that previously has not been talked about much and needs to be more. And so I really appreciate this presentation, Commissioner Saltzman, so that folks know that there is a place, a safe place to go that is effective in getting help. And I've been proud to partner with you and save the funding for some of these programs in the most recent budget. We'll continue to do so because there is nothing more important than feeling safe in your home. Aye.
Fish.
I, too, want to add my voice of thanks to Dan, who has been a tireless champion in this area for a long time. And this is yet another example of something where when Dan sets his mind on something, he doesn't stop till he gets the job done. And the other thing I want to just acknowledge is I don't think we spend enough time recognizing the strong partnerships that the city and the county have. And the good ones slip under the radar because they're not controversial. But the reality is this legislative body has superb relationships with our counterparts at the county. And we're very fortunate in Chair Kogan to have someone who has built relationships with everyone up here and works very collaboratively with us. So I want to thank the county for their role. And also our nonprofit providers. It's interesting, the housing commissioner, we don't actually build housing. We contract with mission-driven nonprofits who are virtually the same as the ones, Martha, that you work with, who in fact build and operate the housing. And that's why the quality of services that we fund in our community is so strong, because of groups like LifeWorks, because of Volunteers of America, Oregon, because of all these unique partnerships. So Martha, thank you for your strong leadership. Dan, thank you for your tireless work in this area, and I'm proud to add my support. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I'd like to thank all of our partners at the Gateway Center. Commissioner Fish mentioned Multnomah County, but I particularly want to recognize the court, and in particular Chief Justice Ballmer and Judge McKnight, for your partnership to not only provide the automated restraining orders, but to help the technology to facilitate restraining orders is really a big boost for victims of domestic violence. As Martha pointed out, it's a pretty significant statistic. 40% of all restraining orders filed last year were filed through the Gateway Center. And I can only see that percentage growing with the use of the automated restraining order technology. So that's a big leap forward for making it easier for people to get justice or to be safe as they so deserve. I wanted to also thank the other Gateway staff, Karina Rukova and Diana Lee, who are here today, along with Martha. They are sort of the glue that makes everything work in that universe at the Gateway Center that you saw on the PowerPoint. And I particularly want to thank, as we recognize Multnomah County, but I also want to recognize Multnomah County Sheriff Dan Staton. He provides, at no cost to us, the security we need, the facility security officer. It's a very important presence that makes people feel safer when they're coming to the center under circumstances that are often traumatic. And then finally, I want to recognize members of our Gateway Advisory Committee for all their help, and also Shannon Callahan in my office, who is always has also been the glue in my office that has helped make the Gateway Center a reality. So she's taken it from concept to reality, and she deserves a lot of credit as well. So please to vote aye. The motion or the resolution is adopted, and then we can call the roll on accepting the report.
Did you want a motion to accept the report?
Oh, we need a motion.
Moved. Second.
Okay, please call the roll.
Fritz?
Well, thank you again for all of your work, and Commissioner Saltzman for your leadership. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye. Okay, the report is accepted, and we move on to our regular agenda. We have a S-1110.
S-1110, adopt new supporting documents for an update of Portland's comprehensive plan.
Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Joe Zender with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and with Tom Armstrong, also from the Bureau. We're here today for a second reading of the factual basis for the update of the city's comprehensive plan. At your last meeting, you adopted an amended ordinance and report. In the interim, had met with Commissioner Fritz and provided a briefing. And
Joe, why don't you just turn that one off? You
can.
There you go.
Great. The record was kept open until today, so we did not receive any additional testimony in that interim, but I believe there's some folks here to testify today.
Okay. Do you have anything to add?
No.
Okay.
We're here for questions.
Before you move to public testimony, I have just one clarifying issue that came up during the briefing that I had. And that is a detail that in Section 2 on page 9, the town centers are shown, and there's a designation of the West Portland Town Center, and I think of Lentz, as not adopted. And in conversation with Tom, that means that it's the plan is not adopted rather than the center designation is not adopted. So I just wanted to make sure that we can make that amendment as the process moves forward. We wouldn't need a formal amendment for today.
Correct.
Correct. Well, in the future, we'll clarify that designation. We were making a distinction between the St. John's and Hollywood and Hillsdale Town Center that have gone through a formal town center process versus the metro designation.
Right.
In those.
With that legislative intent, I'm comfortable with what's on the table. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So we have some people signed up, Carla?
We did not set out a sign-up sheet. I thought it was a second reading.
Is there anybody here that wishes to testify? Okay, I see one. Bob Salinger, come on up.
This is a sign of your influence, Bob, that you're testifying on a second reading. I compliment you.
Well, thank you for giving me that opportunity. I'm sorry. I thought it was open till through the hearing, so my apologies.
You could give us your name.
Sure. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for Portland Audubon Society. So I just wanted to testify on a narrow point regarding the packet, and that has to do with the economic opportunities analysis and the removal of the two references in that document to the Port of Vancouver as an alternative to developing on West Staten Island. We appreciated the fact that staff put that in there as a potential alternative. We thought that was a very important piece of information that should be included. But right now it is crossed out. It was in the amendments package. Unfortunately, this perpetuates a pattern over the last 20 years of continually removing those kinds of references from documents. Oftentimes they've been put in and then taken out, sort of sanitizing the record of a recognition that West Haven